This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the time frame of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. The paradox of being thoughtful while being faithful is a spiritual practice that has failing currency in Mormonism. As the host of A Thoughtful Faith, Gina has had the opportunity to interview those at their most spiritually troubled who are seeking a middle way that feels authentic, honest, faithful, and Mormon. In this audiovisual presentation, she will talk about what it means to be in dialogue with troubled conversation partners as they discover and share their emergent wisdom with thousands of friends listening in the wilderness. Presenters will speak in the following order. Gina Colvin is the host of A Thoughtful Faith podcast and blogs at Kiwi Mormon. She lives in Christchurch, New Zealand, where she is a lecturer at the University of Canterbury. Paul Malin is a writer and occasionally realistic idealist. He believes in the power of ideas and hopes writing about Mormonism will help his five children make sense of the culture they will inherit. Nathan McCluskey holds a PhD in politics from the University of Canterbury. He was awarded a postdoctoral fellowship from Victoria University, Wellington, New Zealand, and currently works for Statistics New Zealand and is also a union organizer. Katie Langston is pursuing a master's in theology at St. Mary's University of Minnesota and Luther Seminary in the Twin Cities. She is a blogger for Feminist Mormon Housewives.
Can I say thank you so much for joining us today as we wrestle with this notion of certainty. I want to say thank you for joining us. Is that okay?
It's crazy.
I feel quite attracted. Yeah. Nice. So, once again, thank you for joining us today as we wrestle with this notion of certainty. Now, moreover, the proposition that if our quest for certainty is not bound up in the need for institutional validation or is afraid of freedom, wisdom can be its fruits. Now, it does say in the descriptor that this is an audio-visual presentation. It will be somewhat, but you can hear us vaguely, and you can see us, so that's our audio-visual. It sort of evolved out of a conversation with each other where we actually were finding our places within this conversation. So the panel is part of the A Thoughtful Faith community, and we're each of us different in terms of the way we think about religious certainty and wisdom. Now, Katie Langston, who is at the end of the table there, she has largely removed herself from a holy Mormon faith life and is pursuing orders, aren't you, in the Lutheran Church? Yep. For Katie, her quest for certainty has led her into a different faith system. For Paul and myself, we operate in this middle way where our deepest unquenched thirst for transcendence haven't taken us entirely away from Mormonism, but has caused us to develop a spiritual questing that seeks for compromise and critique and even involves crisis. Now, Nathan, my husband, occupies the other space closest to the mainstream. Recently on the bishopric, he worked alongside the bishop to create an inclusive ward that was renowned for its unconventionality while maintaining the core practices, policies, and belief systems of the church. So we're here representing a spectrum of engagement, but we are united in our commitments to a faith life, but differ gloriously in the way we express that. So we're going to begin by Nathan on the right. As we go to the left. Thank you, Nathan.
I don't know what it's going to say, actually.
Recognizing there's a problem with the microphone, I'll do my best, Mick Jagger, and speak right into it. You can always get what you want. Hello, my name is Nathan. As you've heard, I'm married to Gina, but I don't get out much. As a result, I'm quite nervous about this experience, so I appreciate you bearing with me. I'm presenting to you today because Gina said it would significantly cut the price of my entry to the symposium. Before I start, I should confess that this is my first time to a Sunstone symposium and my first time to the United States of America. Please don't shoot me. I bleed easily. I find myself today a living definition of irony. My wife has described me to the world, gratefully not in her introduction exactly in these words, but in other settings, as a conservative orthodox TBM. So I will treat this much like a sacrament talk. At some point I may cry. I appreciate your understanding. She thinks TBM means true believing Mormon. I think it means truly blessed male. The first label comes pretty naturally. The second requires me to name my privilege. My guess is that most here who do go to an LDS church on Sunday, particularly in this state, feel a little like square pegs in round holes, whereas people like me fit in like a hand in a glove. However, today, I feel like the object of the Sesame Street song, "One of these things just doesn't belong here. One of these things just isn't the same." Sing along. "One of these things just doesn't belong here. Now it's time to play our game. It's time to play our game. Do, 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 do." I don't... You're much more encouraging than Gina is. Thank you. I don't know the rest of the words, so you're let off the hook. So I now get to experience what it's like to be the weird one. Gina tells me it'll be good for me. It's not over yet. On the other hand, when I looked at the topic, I thought, that's flippin' awesome, dude. That's about certainty. TBM specialise in this space. That made me feel a lot more comfortable as I realised that I'm probably the most qualified presenter on the panel to speak to this. I love getting the right answer, whereas you're all comfortable in the soup of uncertainty. Some of you may now be measuring me up against Fowler's Stages of Faith and saying to yourselves, somewhat condescendingly and patronisingly, if you're anything like my wife, "You poor wee thing, if only you'd grow up spiritually, you'd be much more enlightened. She lives in hope." I don't, because apparently there's no going back from the glorious uncertainty she has worked hard to find. Because I'm a TBM, I like stories. Our kind struggle with complex theoretical constructs and enjoy platitudes and life experiences much more. Thomas S. Monson is therefore my favourite conference speaker. Even if I've heard that story before, thrice, given this, I hope you will indulge me in sharing a story of my own, which illustrates for me the relationship between wisdom and certainty. As some of you may be aware, 4 years ago, our city of Christchurch was struck by a magnitude 6.3 earthquake. See, I told you. With 2.2 G's of peak ground acceleration, one of the highest ever recorded PGAs in the world. While the quake itself killed 185 people directly, its effects resulted in the destruction of approximately 80% of our central business district. New Zealand is a small country, and Christchurch is even smaller. Most people knew someone who had died. And everyone had a survivor's story. Not like on TV, a real one. It was an experience that only those who have lived through natural disasters know and understand. It made every one of us a little less certain of our lives, less certain of our relationships with material goods in particular, less certain of our jobs, and even for some, less certain of our faith. As a result of the massive changes that this caused to the physical structure of Christchurch and the concomitant human migration out of those areas most affected and the region generally, the city wards in the South Island's only stake had to be reorganised due to loss of personnel and member movement. A couple of wards were disestablished and a new one created. We were fortunate enough to be in a brand new ward. I was called to be the first councillor on the bishopric. Our bishop was a structural engineer and also an urban search and rescue engineer who was heavily involved in human recovery efforts after the earthquake. I remember our first bishopric meeting where we talked about the kind of ward we wanted. We had a blank canvas and no traditions to maintain outside of the handbook. We could write our own story. We decided that what we wanted was a ward that was inclusive, where everyone felt loved and welcome, despite differences of background, ethnicity, language, or gospel perspective. We knew that people were still in shock and that our relationships with each other as a community were more important than focusing on perceived religious conformity. And so we commenced with the premise that everyone who wanted to could and would be invited to contribute. From a pragmatic perspective, it wasn't like we had a lot of choice anyway. When sacrament attendance hovers around 100, we didn't have the luxury of excluding those who engaged with the curriculum material in unconventional ways. Thus began a ward ethos that we both saw as simply Christian, in which any testimony was acceptable, in which the sincerity of individual members' beliefs were more important than the content of them, and that even though we had a very diverse ward with considerably high numbers of educated middle-class saints, we had an equal number of working-class migrants, and therefore we needed to rely on the infinite grace of God to breach the gaps which may exist. Paul put it this way in his second epistle to the Corinthians. This is in chapter 1, verse 12. For our rejoicing is this, the testimony of our conscience, that in simplicity and godly sincerity, not with fleshly wisdom, but by the grace of God, we have had our conversation in the world, and more abundantly to you, ward. I believe this attitude was reflected in the way we did business. Some concrete examples follow. My wife has shared the story before of how she unloaded on Bishop her angst about a range of incongruities between her understanding of the gospel and the inner workings of the corporate church, to which Bishop responded, "I don't know much about those things, but they seem jolly interesting." "The thing is that we love you. Do you love us?" Fortunately, Gina responded that she did. And he said, "Well, I guess that's what really matters then." On another occasion, I interviewed an elderly sister in the ward to extend a call to her. She said, "I don't think you'd want me." I asked why, and she responded, "I don't think I'm a very good member of the church." When I inquired as to why she thought that, she said that she didn't agree with certain aspects of the Old Testament. I told her not to worry too much about that because Jesus didn't agree with some of them either. Which is why he changed them. She was happy with that and accepted the call. Another brother in the ward, who described himself as a big tent Mormon, was extended a call to serve in the Sunday school presidency. He said, "My beliefs differ quite significantly from the curriculum material, and I can't teach what I don't believe." I asked, "Can you teach the truth?" He looked at me sideways and said, "Yes." I said, "Great, you've got the job." Sometimes when he was filling in for absent teachers, he would teach the youth about evolution, or the adults about Joseph's dodgy dealings with the Kirtland Savings Society. And on the Bishopric, we just felt that it added interest to the lessons and made them more memorable for the class. This, along with another fun story I don't have time for here, contributed to our ward becoming known as the special ward by us, by our Area Authority 70. But it also became a magnet for some refugees from other wards who recognised Christ and the freedom of expression we encouraged. Our bishopric has now been released. No, not like that. I don't think. But it is not uncommon for people to still mention how much they loved that period in our new ward's history. I've shared this story because even though I am someone who likes to find certainty, like many of my kind, if I am to be truly honest, I recognise that it isn't a case of people like me and people like you. Because in reality, we all exist somewhere along a certainty spectrum. And I believe there are very few things we really know for sure. Therefore, the wisdom I have found in the quest for certainty is that everyone's perspective contributes to that. We can never be certain of anything if that which we feel certain about is never challenged or questioned. It just is. Unless we test each other by allowing for the testimony of everyone's conscience to be openly shared, our absence of doubt will exist because of the absence of an alternative, not because of the presence of powerful principles. The gospel principles I believe in stand firm because they are challenged, not in spite of the challenges. While many of my kind would see the disciplining of dissent as an act of victory, I see it as an act of surrender. Joseph Smith said, "The truth of God will go forth boldly, nobly, and independent." But I say, as well, doctrines with no divine origin will die, and so they should. It is through openness, honesty, freedom, challenge, and dissent that wisdom reveals that about which we can be certain. For as Christ said in Matthew 11:19, wisdom is justified of her children. The seeker of truth will recognize those children. One of them may be certainty, but it will be the kind of certainty that is not afraid of being presented with alternatives. For from amongst them, it will float to the surface and rise above the shadows into the light of resplendent and divine knowledge. Then are wisdom and certainty linked in full felicity. Thank you.
Have an apology for my husband later on. I think he might belong here a little bit. So I kind of, as some of you know, I'm situated in a spectrum just a little bit along from that. And I've purposely coupled this idea of the quest for certainty with finding wisdom, because and it's on the surface a really unusual pairing, because certainty is often associated with dogma and fixedness, and so I'm personally troubled by the pursuit of certainty when it's bounded and delimits further interrogation, when it becomes a tyranny, because that to me is not wisdom. Now, let me illustrate what I mean. I'm going to get a little bit academic on us. When I raise a concern with a fear-based question, quest for certainty, in cultural studies, which is my field, this what we call a discursive turn, it's sometimes called the second cognitive revolution, indicates that there to be a large-scale shift in the way that humans, at this present time, make sense of the world. We've gone from looking for objective scientific meta-answers to the world's ills to looking at the kind of language we use to create meaning and how that language of certainty shapes our identities and gives us a sense of being part of something that has ultimate control of us. For instance, rather than arguing whether or not the church is actually true, we could be considering how we've come to use the word know and true, and therefore thinking about the institutional and interpersonal work that these terms are performing in the church. I'll give you an example in a minute. In other words, how has this statement, "I know the church is true," worked to influence our spiritual and our religious experiences? Currently, the academic fashion is one in which several disciplines are thinking about how we make sense of the world, in which there is ambiguity, contradiction, and complexity. And as Nathan's pointed out, I like that stuff. Not everybody does. Now, these days, we're less inclined to nail down meanings as definitive. Even in the church, there's been a bit of a sea change from the podium thumping hellfire and damnation preaching of the previous generation, of which Bruce McConkie was the archetype. For example, in 1982, Bruce McConkie gave this controversial BYU devotional speech, "Our Relationship with the Lord." Some of you maybe remember that, when he proclaimed that we shouldn't be worshipping Christ. He was the past master of the definitive and the declaratory. And if you look closely at this talk, you'll notice how he uses particular devices to bat away doubt. "I shall set forth what we must believe. I shall expound the doctrine. We will set forth the view of the brethren and those who understand the scriptures. Don't set too much stock in the current views and vagaries that are afloat. Stay in the mainstream." And this is followed by several "we know, we believe" statements. As his rhetorical approach was geared towards doing a particular work which made sense somewhat last century and fit this Fordist, post-Fordist mass production and regulatory kind of theology. Yet Gordon B. Hinckley in this century, was it last century? This century, well, some century, gained some notoriety for saying on several occasions, "I don't know." Now, naysayers wonder how he can be a prophet and not know something. But I'm personally happier with a prophet who knows his mortal imperfections and his lack of understanding and owns that and is honest about it. I think we've overinflated the prophetic call as something akin to Adam walking and talking with God in the Garden of Eden, which I think is a bit of a nonsense. Quentin Cook, speaking at the October conference, stated, "While we don't know all of the answers." And this is at odds with Brigham Young, who frequently suggested that Mormonism has all of the answers to everything and anything true. He claimed to be Mormonism. So rather than being told what is true and simply swallowing it, Richard G. Scott suggests that we can know for ourselves. The scriptures are true, he says, by our personal study and prayer. And this isn't an unusual statement in Mormonism and goes right back to Joseph Smith, who suggested that as a religious community, our spiritual self-empowerment is more important than blind faith. So we're in this place of paradox. And this gives rise to an impression that in order for our theology to be relevant at this time in the world's history, it does require a certain degree of modesty and a pulling back from declarations of certainty. There is something alienating about statements of knowing that are communicated as certainties. Even Fox figured that out when they turfed out Glenn Beck. The problem with religious certainty is that it has in the past sought to colonize and regularize our personal religious experiences. It sought to make sense of the deepest and most profound experience of our souls and has ascribed to them a churched language in order to apprehend our loyalty. Now, I can understand how this might be necessary. Religions build communities. Communities thus established generally share a language of conviction, and that shared conviction builds belonging. However, I do believe, and this is my central thesis, that we are at a stage where the challenge for us is to put together a community that is relevant and for today, which it would seem means reshaping, but not abandoning altogether, our desire for certainty. Now,
At this point, I would want to acknowledge with love and concern and even empathy this time where sometimes our only felt option and our only practical alternative seem to be the choice between truth or untruth, certainty or doubt, or even more compellingly, a decision to be either in or out. But I want to propose a faith life that is commensurate with both the loving, fearless, and generous quest to be certain about something in this world, even if all you express as your certainty is what Krista Tippett calls a moral longing to repair the world. This interplay between a faith life, the quest for certainty, and the blessing of wisdom can be profound and ultimately gratifying, even enlightening. The pursuit for certainty, for moral conviction, and for understanding is by no means redundant, even in our postmodern time. Krista Tippett mused, "I'm repeatedly amazed at such clear-eyed instincts of faith and how they stand in spectacular contrast to faith's current reputation for meanness and smallness. Clear-eyed faith asks me to confront my failings and the world's horrors. It also demands that I search within all of the wreckage for the seeds of creativity, wisdom, and strength. It frees me from the contours of virtue alive in the world of thick religion, grounded and refined in practice and in thought and text and tradition and responding in different ways to human reality." So I want to acknowledge, as I conclude, my own conversation partners in a Thoughtful Faith podcast, where we've been given so much to us by way of their wisdom. Without exception, these are extraordinary people who are actively looking for ways to construct a thick religion and to be thoughtful and mindful in our spiritual meanderings. Peter and Liz Kamick, my former bishop's wife and her husband, who love the church and have maintained a faith that has always been hopeful inside the church, yet expansive. And then Kate Kelly, who in this flush of the April 2014 action optimistically stated her absolute faith that in the end revelation would prevail. Sarah Burlingame, who though a former Baha'i Unitarian Universalist, she has made Mormon feminist her people. James Ord, who is the Salt Lake attorney, who gave me the rundown of how the property arm of Salt Lake City kind of plays out in a place like New Zealand. Joseph Peterson, where we double-handedly offer the church an opportunity to rework their appalling PR practice. And Chris Black, who resigned from the church in the wake of the purges and just rejoined the other week in the wake of another round of purges. Daniel Lancaster, who recently wrote a wonderful autoethnography about his mission in Jamaica as a way to deal with his post-mission trauma. Emma and Roy Hahn from Scotland, who discovered how punitive and self-defeating the church administration can be when they're invited to be part of a major British television series about the Hahn's unusually large family. And then, of course, there's Bob, who's with us today, Bob Rees, who made thousands of people weep with his beautiful, powerful account of his service in the church and those things which had hurt him despite his faith. I've had the enormous privilege of eliciting and witnessing the stories of immensely faith-oriented Mormons who wrestle with personal questions and their doubts and their sometimes failing faith, while at the same time nursing their hopefulness for something better, more transcendent and more loving. Last year, I met with someone from the church offices who snuck me into the church office building. But anyway, he affirmed to me that change will come to the church. It won't come from the church. The work that each of us do, no matter how painful and confusing or difficult, is both holy and sacred. The quest for certainty that is open and unbounded will lead, yes, to complexity and pain, but ultimately, if we allow that pain to do its work, it will lead us to wisdom. Thank you.
I'm going to pick this up first, sorry. Sorry, I follow instructions, so this is audiovisual. Okay, unfortunately, I have a much stronger voice when I'm hiding behind my keyboard, but I am actually kind of happy to be here, kind of excited. This is my first Sunstone as well. Since we're all at Sunstone and since we're in this session together, I can kind of assume, I think, that everybody here has felt at one time or another that we are not Mormon enough, whatever that means.
Can you speak closer to the microphone?
Yes, I thought I was doing a good job. All right, like that? Better? Oh, good. So I'll just start again. So I'm assuming that everybody here, since we're in this session, has felt at one time or another that we are not Mormon enough, whatever that means. I'm going to tell a story about a time in my life when I felt I was not Mormon enough, and we'll see how it comes together. Maybe. This is my daughter, Kate, on her 8th birthday. You can see she doesn't even remember what was in that box. I'm sure she doesn't. But at the time, she was very excited. And you can see that by looking at the picture. What you can't tell from the picture is that on the other side of the camera, I was full of dread. Not because she turned 8. This isn't a story about baptizing a child. I had just declined a phone call. My phone had rung in my pocket from the Dominican Republic, where my parents were serving together their 4th mission. And I knew based on the time of day and my parents never called that it couldn't be good news. But I also knew my daughter needed my attention for at least a few minutes. So I ignored the call, kept taking pictures. And a few minutes later, I would learn that my father had had a massive stroke. And was then in surgery. My mom is very cool and collected. She didn't seem concerned. She didn't feel alone because she was surrounded by missionaries. And she'd had a blessing from a general authority, and he didn't seem worried, so why should she? She said there was no reason for any of us to fly down there. The following morning, I followed up because it didn't seem right. It turns out that the reason the general authority hadn't been concerned is because he had made his career in medicine and was used to watching people die. When he realized that he'd been misinterpreted the night before, my mom called again with a much more urgent call. And we went down. I was one of seven, the youngest of seven. Three of us were flexible enough to go down, so I am one of two apostates. The other two that came with me were not. And so we made the journey down to the Dominican Republic and went pretty immediately to the hospital. The hospital there is much smaller than American hospitals. And there was no consultation room, so they let us into this little office that had 10 or 15 monitors and not a tissue to be found, where a doctor told us that the surgery had not been enough. There was no response. My dad was essentially brain dead. There was a machine keeping him alive. So she gave us a minute to consider our options with this general authority who had, not kidding, had written a textbook called Extracorporeal Life Support Systems. He'd written a book about life support, and we asked him what he would do if it had been his wife, and he said without hesitation, pull the plug. So we went in and said goodbye to my dad, and I imagine I'm not the only one here who has had that kind of experience where you walk into a room with a loved one and you know the room is empty. The machine was breathing. My dad wasn't there. So we said our goodbyes, and we told the doctor he had a living will that instructed them to pull the plug. And she seemed surprised and said, oh, no, in the Dominican Republic, only God decides when life ends. It's not even legal for me to pull the plug, and I wouldn't do it anyway. I'm a Catholic. There's no way I would pull that plug. But she said, don't worry, ironically enough, his kidney's failing. He'll be dead soon. So we went back to the missionary apartment, which was on the temple grounds. This is my mom saying goodbye to the man she married 53 years before. The apartment where my parents were staying was next to the temple. We went back, and it was a very surreal experience for us to walk back into my father's life without him there. Little bits of him, the clothes he was going to wear the next day. He called this hat his bonnet. Little bits of his life stored in a hat. And unfinished business. Genealogy was his passion. So we sat and waited for a phone call that we expected would come any time. When the call did come, they told us his organs had rebounded. Which should have been good news. But we learned in the coming days that he was facing exactly what he didn't want, what the living will was determined to avoid, which was weeks or months or even years in a coma. About that same time, the church's medical office contacted us and said that there was a problem with my parents' insurance. They didn't have insurance outside the country. And they also said that they had declined to sign a form that would have let us fly my father home. And so we were facing an $80,000 medical transport fee. We didn't know anything about foreign insurance or medical evacuations or anything, and we knew much less about how to interact with the church to try to inspire help without crossing the apparent hierarchy that was there. And I don't want you to misunderstand. In 2 weeks of dealing with general authorities and mission presidents and some of the kindest, most compassionate people I've ever met, every one of them loved my parents and was trying to do the right thing. But the institution is so top down that everybody was afraid to speak. They didn't want to say anything that might contradict what the next person above them would say when or if they ever got around to speaking. We were stuck. If you've been in a situation like this where you're missing a loved one and got a whole lot of time on your hands, maybe you did what I did, which was turn to my email and look through old conversations with my dad and wish that there was more substance there. I had to go back through a lot of tech support emails. The Wi-Fi was broken, the printer was broken. Have you seen what liberal politics is doing to America? Eventually, I found that last conversation with my dad, which ended something like this. I love you, and I'm proud of your talent, but I hope you remember who you are while you still have time to make a difference. What my father was saying, in a very kind, good-hearted attempt, very much like Father Lehi, perhaps, was I was not Mormon enough. My beard is rebellious, my example is lacking, my faith is weak. My talent for words is wasted because I'm not using it to bring people to the church. What I realized when I reread that email was that I had forgotten who I am. From the time we landed in the Dominican Republic, I had become passive and obedient and accepting of the answers. When somebody told me that there was nothing we could do, I just said, okay, I guess there's nothing we can do. I had become my 12-year-old self. So when I read that email, I realized I hadn't even looked into this. So the following morning, my mom and sisters went to the temple. I walked to the embassy and made a million phone calls. I quickly learned that there was nothing wrong with their insurance. I also learned that for a bargain price of $50,000, you can fly somebody home in a medical jet. And I asked impertinent questions of every church leader that I could reach, which wasn't too many people. But I did learn that the brethren were aware of the situation and were talking about it. Well, that was great. I was talking about it too. And I wasn't about to leave my mom on an island to watch her husband die in slow motion. Some of the less helpful responses from the leadership were, don't worry, we'll always make sure your mom has a ride to the hospital, and she can stay in the apartment as long as she needs. Which is real. I mean, they were trying to be helpful, you understand, but from our perspective, very detached. So I kept pushing, and in one of the most humbling experiences of my life, maybe with help from you in this room, I don't know, because there were so many anonymous donations, we were able to raise more than half of the money we needed to fly my dad home. The other half I arranged through my employer so we could sort out the money later and just get him home. So I booked the medical evacuation. And that afternoon, the temple department called and very heroically said, don't worry about it, we'll handle the whole thing. And I said, that's really nice of you, but we've already handled the whole thing, but we'd sure... I was so happy and grateful, I hope I don't sound ungrateful, that they had not forgotten my father who had served them in his fifth mission. So 2 weeks after his stroke, we loaded my father into this small airplane. We crossed our fingers, and we flew back to an American hospital where they confirmed what we already knew. They honored his living will. We played his favorite hymn, and we said goodbye. And he didn't die. My mom asked my brother to repeat the priesthood blessing, which the general authority had given in the Dominican Republic, releasing him from life. My dad was always the kind of person who would wait for permission. And maybe he wasn't around then. So my brother released him again, and he still didn't die. It's a very bizarre feeling, by the way, to be in a hospital room hoping that somebody you love so much will die. After a couple of days, my mom asked my brother again if he would. My brother hesitated, and I surprised everybody, certainly myself, by standing up and saying, "Hey, do you mind if I do it?" So even though I was sure I was not Mormon enough, I placed my hands on my father's head, and I gave my priest a blessing, and he died. Not right then, that would be too Hollywood, but when he died later that night, my mom suggested that he had been waiting for me, his wayward son, to tell him it was okay to go. I don't think I agree with that. I think, if anything, he was giving me an opportunity to understand that I am Mormon enough. Maybe not to be a bishop, maybe not to meet his standards or even shave my face or whatever seems so important sometimes, but I am Mormon enough to participate with my family and this community in a meaningful way. And I can tell you, I'm a lousy Mormon. If you choose any Mormon doctrine and put it out there, I probably don't believe it. So if a guy like me can spend a couple weeks hanging out with general authorities and walk away feeling that I am Mormon enough, I am certain everyone in this room is also Mormon enough, whatever that means. Thanks.
Feedback. Well, thank you so much. It's a real honor to be here, and I've loved the entire panel so far. So thank you. I feel honored to be included in this mix. The topic of the panel today deals with the idea of seeking a middle way that feels authentic, honest, faithful, and Mormon. And that's an interesting dilemma for me because my faith journey has led me to theological places that aren't necessarily particularly Mormon. I grew up in a very strict Orthodox Mormon home, and I internalized very strict works righteousness sense of spirituality, the idea that I could only be acceptable to God through worthiness and obedience. It contributed to some very serious anxiety problems and an overall sense of shame about myself and a belief in my own perpetual unworthiness. About 10 years ago, I reached a low point. And just at that moment, grace burst into my life and heart. And it changed me fundamentally from the inside out. It gave me hope and a knowledge that I am loved and I'm okay no matter what. I attribute this experience to God, and since then, the more I have come to know God, the more I have come to see that God is grace and God is love. And I've been drawn more and more to a non-LDS Christian tradition. And so my wrestle with Mormonism has come from this place of experiencing God one way and experiencing Mormonism another way. And yet at the same time, I am profoundly and deeply Mormon. And so for me, navigating a middle way is about learning to honor both parts of myself. And so I'd like to share a piece I wrote recently about that. I'll start by reading a poem, though, by Courtney Davis called "Everything in Life is Divided." Everything in life is divided. 24 hours that fade from day to night, The sand at Martha's Vineyard, where we vacationed last year, separating us from the ocean where we swam, then returned to our blanket, the two of us making one marriage, sharing the apple sliced to reveal the identical black seeds of its surprised face. Even our bodies can be halved, although less evenly, lungs partitioned into lobes, the heart's blood pumped from left to right, the brain's two hemispheres directing our arms, our legs, our lives into the two possibilities of the Greek mask. My life's work, too, is divided. On one side of my desk, unfinished poems, and on the other, nursing books with dog-eared pages. Aren't we all somehow divided? Like when my daughter was in labor, my first grandchild emerging into the room's blue air, suddenly entering new territory, and how, when after the delivery my daughter kept bleeding, I couldn't look at the newborn in the incubator but stood fast beside my child, the woman who once slipped from my life into her own and now had divided herself again, while I balanced in my hands joy and fear, cradling them both until the bleeding stopped. About 8 months ago, I started attending a new church in my neighborhood. I say attending, but that's not entirely accurate. It's more than passive attendance. I coordinate the Altar Guild. I spoke on Easter Sunday. I'm on the fundraising committee. I make the coffee once a month for services, though I've warned them that if the quality is bad, that's what they get when they ask the Mormon to make the coffee. I guess that's the problem, though. I still think of myself as the Mormon. I love my new church, but not infrequently I feel pangs of longing for Mormonism. It's not that I'm done with Mormonism forever. My husband and children are still active Mormons, and I accompany them to church on Sunday, all 3 hours. I sit in the pews, sing the hymns, say amen to the prayers, but it's not the same. The familiar rhythms of Mormonism, once the only spiritual language I knew, now feel oddly disconnected, like when you return to your hometown after you've lived somewhere else, only to realize that it's not really your home anymore. My separation from Mormonism wasn't entirely voluntary. Over the past months and years, I've watched, helpless and heartbroken, as the church I was raised in repeated the sins of its past, turning away from difficulty when it should have turned toward it, deflecting honest critique when it should have listened openly, excommunicating and silencing thoughtful believers when it should have enfolded them in the arms of fellowship. They drew the circle smaller and smaller until I woke up one morning and realized it no longer included me. Simultaneously, I felt a pull toward another kind of life, one of public ministry, of Christian leadership. When I'm honest, I recognize that I've always felt drawn to ministry from the time I was a missionary in Bulgaria, perhaps earlier. As a Mormon, I hoped for teaching and leadership callings because they filled me in a way that nothing else did. I felt joyful and alive when I was speaking, teaching, or thinking about faith. I wanted my life to be deeply involved in God's work in a way that I never saw modeled as a Mormon woman. Doing my visiting teaching and floating from ward calling to ward calling, while meaningful in many ways, didn't fill the part of my heart that yearned for a more encompassing path. I've since learned the word for that, by the way. It's vocation, and I am entering seminary in the fall. Sometimes I wonder if I should shrug off my Mormon identity entirely. But how can I deny my Mormonism when there are parts of me that are still so deeply Mormon? I'm not sure I'll ever be able to shake them. I'm not sure I want to. I catch glimpses of the expansiveness of the Mormon cosmos, of its reckless radical theology, and it takes my breath away. I could believe that. I do believe that. How can I ever be anything but a Mormon? But how can I be a Mormon when there are parts of me that are still so deep, that are so deeply Christian? I don't say that to rehash the tired question of Mormonism's Christianity, but rather to express my alignment with the broader faith tradition I now claim. Mormonism has separated itself from the body of Christ with its insistence on one and only. I believe in a God of scandalous grace, who tears down walls instead of building them up, who rejects worthiness checklists in favor of the earth-shattering declaration, "You are enough." This truth has revolutionized my life and filled me with peace I didn't know was possible. How can I ever be anything but a Christian? And so in many ways, it has seemed to me that the process of discernment and the search is a process of division. Two authentic parts competing for dominance, and in choosing one, the other must fade away. But what if there is another way? I see both parts of myself, the Mormon part and the Christian part, and they are both integral to who I am. All my life I was told I had to pick one or the other, that I could only be one thing, but such strict black and white binaries don't reflect the God I have come to know. Great art is comprised of more than one color. A single day progresses from dark to light to dark again. Jesus is fully human and fully divine. All truth is circumscribed to one great whole. So today I claim me, all of me. The Mormon me, the Christian me, the contradictions and the fragments, the conflict and the friction. I claim all the experiences God has given me. I claim my mistakes and I claim my courage. Perhaps the process of discernment is division. Or perhaps it's in discovering that embracing what is true in all its messiness, complexity, and wholeness, there is no division after all.
I thank our panel today. They did such a wonderful job sharing their messages with us. We can give them one more hand. We probably only have time for one or two questions. If you'd like to ask something, please come up and ask into the mic so that the recording can catch it. Thank you.
I'm so glad that I came to this. Everything was amazing. This is my struggle. I'm not active. But I'm still Mormon. And the people that try to deny who you are and your belonging, the othering, the second that you step out of the box, the second you question the box, you're somewhere else. And I really just appreciate so much what you said. And feeling less alone in the claiming of Mormonism and who I am. So, question. Thank you.